Then the king said to the Cushite, "Is it well with the young man Absalom?" And the Cushite answered, "Let the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be as that young man." The king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And thus he said as he walked, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Those are the words you probably recognize of those of King David, weeping after the loss of his son, receiving news that his son had been killed, the son that he deeply cared about. I want to look at this story tonight and try to draw some lessons that can be applicable to us in our day. I've titled it Lessons from the Life and Death of Absalom, A Father's Love for a Rebellious Son. We're going to be spending quite a bit of time in the book of 2 Samuel. In just a few moments, we're going to be going back to 2 Samuel 11 and going back a little bit in history, really before Absalom really comes on the scene. But I think it's necessary to do that. And if you want to follow along, in just a few moments, we'll be going back to 2 Samuel 11. But as you're turning there, let me say, already been said, I think we have visitors here. In fact, I know that we do. And we're grateful for your presence and glad to have you here with us. Hope the things that we do and say here will be things that will be edifying to you. And most of all, things that are pleasing to God. I want to say to the elders, I appreciate the opportunity to speak, particularly since Jeff is away tonight. He is, if you're expecting him tonight, you'll be disappointed. He is he's traveled up to Kentucky to be with his family. We have a lot of our own number that are gone tonight, and taking advantage of the holiday weekend, obviously. But we're glad that you're here, as Freddie has already said. I have to say, explain a little bit about the bulletin. I've twice tried to put Brent and in the family of the Claxtons, Brent and Nina Claxton. I've done that twice. First time was a real big mistake. I just didn't watch what I was doing. But the second time, I realized I needed to put something in there about the classes. Instead of typing it out, I was lazy and went back and I said, "Well, I'll just copy from an old bulletin." And it just happened to be the one that I had made the mistake the first time was the one I chose to copy out of and didn't even read it. So I apologize to all those, and next time I'll try to get it right anyway. Well, as we introduce, we're going to be talking about Absalom tonight. But in order to talk about Absalom, you really have to talk about David. And you really have to understand a lot of what happened in David's life to understand what happened in Absalom's life. And that's why I want us to go back now to the book of 2 Samuel 11. As we get to this point in history, and we're going to spend a good bit of time looking at the story, and I hope that won't be, I realize that it is probably familiar to many of you, but I think it's necessary to understand the story to really understand some of the lessons that we draw from it. By this time, David is very well established as king. In fact, he is very well established even as far back as chapter 5 of 2 Samuel. He has taken the throne that was once given to Saul, and now he is king. And he has been very successful in defeating many of his enemies. And in this particular case, in chapter 10, he's defeated the Ammonites and the Arameans, or the Syrians in some Bibles, as who have been hired to help them. And as chapter 11 begins, it says that it happened in the spring, the time when kings go out to battle, that David sent Joab and his servants with him and all Israel, and they destroyed the sons of Ammon and besieged Rabbah. But David stayed at Jerusalem. Seems to be uncharacteristic of a king for this type of year. They would go out and have battles that time of year in the spring, probably, I'm assuming, due to the better weather. But as David was there one night in that spring, apparently he got up, well, not apparently, but he did get up from his bed, maybe because he couldn't sleep. And he got up from his bed one night and walked around on the roof. Now, that may sound odd to many of us. I don't normally get up from my bed at night and walk around on the roof. But in this case, that wasn't so unusual because the architecture of the day and the design of homes that day were designed to make use of the roof. And he went up on his roof and was looking out, and he saw a very beautiful woman bathing. And he inquired about her. And someone said, "Well, this is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. So David sent messengers to her, had her brought to him, and they committed adultery with one another. And she went back home, and after the course of time, she discovered that she was with child. As a result of that union, her husband Uriah the Hittite was in the army, so he wasn't at home. So she sent word to David, saying, "I am pregnant." And David sent to Joab, saying, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And I'm getting a little ahead of my slide here. So he has Uriah brought home. See, he's got a problem now that he's got to cover. So he has Uriah sent back home from the army. And he converses with Uriah, ask about how things are going, how the people are doing. And he just assumes, as any normal man would want to do, that he would go home to his wife and be with her. But he did not do that. In his integrity, he decided that he was going to sleep outside, down by the king's gate with the servants. So David calls him in the next day and asks him about that. And he says, "Well, I'm not going to go down and be with my wife when the soldiers are out, the servants of Joab are out, or your servants are out with Joab, sleeping in the open field, and the Ark of God's in a tent." So this time, next night, he makes him drunk, has him drink. And he just figures, perhaps in a not a sober state of mind, this time he would go down to his wife and be with his wife and assume the child born would be his. But he didn't do it. So David has to come up with a plan B. And I think most of us know this story. He writes a letter to Joab and says, "Put Uriah in the fiercest part of the battle and withdraw your forces so that he may be struck down and die." And he actually sends the letter by the hand of Uriah. Well, that happened. Joab did just as he was told. He put Uriah in a place that he knew there would be valiant men. And Uriah dies, and he sends word back. And David said, "Well, the sword devours one as he does the other." As though this was just one person is just as likely to be killed as another, when in reality it was prearranged. Well, Bathsheba mourned for her husband a customary amount of time. And then David brought her to his home, took her to be his wife, and eventually she bore him a son. You know, it's like problem solved. Well, not really. God confronts Nathan. God, through Nathan, confronts David. And he brings Nathan to him, and Nathan tells him a story about a rich man having flocks and herds, and this poor man who had one little ewe lamb, female lamb, that stayed with them at the house, one that he treated like a daughter. And the rich man had a traveler come and see him. And instead of taking one from his flocks, he took the poor man's lamb, the one that he loved, and prepared it to serve for the traveler. And when David heard this, he became very angry. He said, "The man doesn't deserve to live. He's going to restore fourfold." Nathan said, "You are the man. You are the man, David." And he tells David that he's going to punish him, that God is going to punish him. He says that the sword is never going to depart from David's house. Evil will be raised up within David's house. David's wives will be given to his companion, and he will lie with them in broad daylight. And the child born to David and Bathsheba will die. I highlighted two in red because I think they have the most significance with our story tonight. Evil raised up within David's house, and David's wives will be given to his companion. Turmoil begins in David's family. And let me say this. God said David told David that he had put away his sin, that he was not going to die, but he would still suffer these consequences as a result of that sin. So in chapter 13, we see turmoil beginning. David's oldest son, Amnon, became very infatuated, in love with his half-sister, Tamar, who was Absalom's full sister. And he was not able to be with her. And it made him sick to a point of being ill. And he had a very shrewd first cousin by the name of Jonadab, a very good friend of his. And Jonadab helped devise a plot that allowed him to get Tamar alone with him. And in the course of events, I'm not going to go into all the details. I think most of you know this story. Tamar came and made food for him. And he had everyone leave, and he got along with her, and he made advances toward her, and she rebuffed his advances, or attempted to. And he, being stronger than her, he violated her, he raped her. And she mourned over this. And her full brother, Absalom, found out what happened. And from that day, Absalom decided that he was going to avenge for what Amnon did. He was going to take vengeance on Amnon for what he did. 2 years later, long time, you think perhaps cooler heads might come into play 2 years later. But Absalom has sheep shearers. Now, I'm not too familiar with the type of culture that places a lot of emphasis on sheep shearers, but apparently this was some big event. Absalom asked David to come down and accompany him to this. But David resisted. Well, we'd just be a burden to you. He said, well, let Amnon come. So it turned out that not only Amnon, but the other king's sons came down with Absalom. And Absalom gave orders to his servants, says, when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, strike him down. He says, be valiant. I've encouraged you to do this. This is my doings, basically, is what he's saying. And he did. That very thing happened. And he killed Amnon. And word initially comes back that all the king's servants had been killed. Of course, then here's Jonadab again. Says, no, it's just Amnon. Because Absalom decided 2 years ago that he was going to avenge for what he did to Tamar. Well, Absalom flees at this point. 3 more years pass, and in the process of time, there's a great mourning for Amnon. But in the process of time, David begins to think about Absalom and wish that he could see Absalom again. Well, Joab recognized this. And Joab attempts to reconcile David and Absalom. He sends a wise woman of Tekoa to David, and she tells a story. And I'm not going to go into all the details of the story, but her story basically is very similar to some of the events that had happened in David's family with respect to Amnon and Absalom. And David eventually perceives what's going on. He understands what's going on here. And he asked the woman, did Joab, is he behind this? And she said yes. And David eventually decides to allow Absalom to come home, but he will not meet with him face to face. Well, the Bible tells us in 2 Samuel 14 that there was no one as handsome or no one as highly praised as Absalom. Apparently he was just a terrific specimen of a person to look at physically. There was no defect in him from head to toe. And he's been home now for 2 years, and he decides he wants to see the king. The king hasn't seen him now for 2 years. And Absalom asks Joab, sends words to Joab, I want to see the king. Well, Joab ignores this, doesn't respond. And after he did it a second time, Absalom told his servants, go down, I've got a field next to Joab's. Set that field on fire. Basically, I'll get his attention. And he did. Joab came to Absalom and said, why aren't your servants set my field on fire? And he said, well, I've been trying to get you to send me to the king, and you won't listen to me. What good is it for me to come from Geshur? He had been in Geshur, living where his grandfather lived. It would be better for me to be there than just be here and not be able to see the king. So Joab arranged at this point for Absalom to meet David face to face. And they reconcile. And the king kisses Absalom. And now he's back in good favor with his father. He's able to see his father. You would think at this point that would be enough. That would be enough for Absalom. He's committed a crime. He's taken justice into his own hands. But it was not enough. As chapter 15 opens, we see that at this point, Absalom provides himself a chariot. And he has horses, I'm assuming, to pull that chariot. 50 men to run before him. Think about it. 50 people to accompany you as you go from place to place. And it says here in verse 2 that Absalom rose early in the morning, and he would stand beside the way to the gate. And if any man had a suit to come to the king for judgment, Absalom would call to him and say, "Well, what city are you from?" And they would say, "Well, I'm from such and such a place." And Absalom would listen to their arguments. And he would say, "Well, you've got good claims. But there's nobody on the part of the king who listens to you. Oh, that someone would appoint me judge in the land. I would make sure that they got justice." And when a man would come near, Absalom would put out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. And it says here in verse 6 that Absalom dealt with all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole away the hearts of the men of Israel. So you see what he's doing here? He's laying forth a conspiracy. And as we go a little further in the chapter, after some period of time, Absalom says to his father, "I made a vow that if God would bring me back to Jerusalem, that I would do this thing. I would pay this vow." And he said, "Let me go to Hebron." And the king said, "Go in peace." Well, he went to Hebron, but he also sent spies out into the land. And this conspiracy had reached a point where people were such in favor of Absalom, and they really liked Absalom to a point that he was able to send spies out into the land and have them ready to appoint that when he told them, "When you hear the sound of the trumpet, you shall say, Absalom is king in Hebron." And the Bible here tells us even that David's advisor, Ahithophel, one of David's closest advisors, had joined Absalom. And we see now that the word comes to David. The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. And David says in verse 14 of chapter 15, "Arise, let us flee, otherwise none of us will escape from Absalom. Go in haste, or he will overtake us quickly and bring down calamity on us and strike the city with the edge of the sword." And it says here that his servants went with him. They left. Again, they're having to leave town because David's own son is coming, and they're in fear of their lives. And he leaves 10 concubines left to keep the house there, David's house in Jerusalem. And it says here eventually that Absalom, at the end of chapter 15, comes to Jerusalem. In fact, the Bible tells us in the latter part of chapter 15 that David goes up the ascent of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went. His head was covered as he walked barefoot. Then all the people who were with him each covered their heads and went weeping as they went. Ahithophel advises David, "Make yourself strong in the house of your father. Go into your father's concubines in the sight of all Israel." Remember one of the punishments that God said he was going to bring upon David? "Your close companion will lie with your wives." This very thing happened at the hands of his own son. And he pitched a tent upon the roof so everybody could see what was going on. And everybody would see this and say, "Well, you know, you don't really care what your father thinks at this point. You're making yourself strong in your father's house." And then he asked advice. He asked Ahithophel first, "Well, how, you know, what should we do?" And I'm assuming that means, "Well, now what should we do? How should we go about taking complete command?" Ahithophel says, "Give me 12,000 men, and I'll lead an immediate pursuit of David. And I will strike him while he is weak and weary and he's exhausted. And I will take him alone, and all the people will come back and be loyal to you." Well, Absalom liked that. Thought that was pretty good advice. And Absalom said, "Well, let's call Hushai, the Archite." Now, Hushai had been an advisor of David as well. But David had sent him back as a plant, in essence, to try to help defeat the counsel of Ahithophel. And Hushai contradicts the advice of Ahithophel. And he says, you don't need to send anybody after your father. You got to be aware your father and the people are going to be very aware that what type of warrior your father is. And if you send a group of people out to him, he'll strike them and he'll defeat them. He may be hidden in some of the caves out there. He'll defeat those people and word will come back. And even the most valiant people that are loyal to you now will lose heart. He says, here's what you do. You need to lead the battle personally, Absalom. You're the one that needs to lead this. So Absalom actually listens to Hushai. And David has crossed the Jordan River. Absalom crosses the Jordan in pursuit of David. In chapter 18, David is setting out his men, the men that are loyal to him. He puts one third under Joab, another third under Abishai, and another under Ittai. He says, then I'm going to go out with the people. But the people said, you should not go out. You know, they don't care about us, but you're worth 10,000 of us. It's better that you stay and be ready to help us from the city. So he listened to the people, but he charged his leaders with this point. Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. And those leaders heard that. Those three men, including Joab. Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom. Well, David's forces defeat Absalom's forces. And as we come to verse 6 of chapter 18, the people go out into the field against Israel. And the battle took place in the forest of Ephraim. And the people of Israel, that is the people loyal to Absalom, were defeated that day, 20,000 men. And verse 9 tells us, as Absalom is meeting David's servants, he's riding a mule, and he gets caught by an oak tree. Can you imagine being riding an animal, and you go under an oak tree, and you get caught by the head in the thick of that oak? And apparently you can't get away. You're stuck. And one of Joab's men, or a man came to Joab and says, I saw Absalom hanging in the oak. You know, he rides under it and the mule keeps going and you're stuck. You're suspended. And Joab sent men word down there and he thrust three javelins or spears into the heart of Absalom. And his armor bearers finished the job. And they killed Absalom. And that leads us to the point that we started with. That Absalom, word came back by means of the Cushite, back to David. Basically said, let all your enemies be as that young man Absalom. And then David began to mourn for his son. What are some lessons that we can learn from this? I know we spent probably an inordinate amount of time looking at the story, but I hope you can see the transition of events that started that night with David's sin with Bathsheba to the events that happened that we just talked about leading up to Absalom's death. And of course, he's saying, O Absalom, my son, my son, would I had died instead of you, O Absalom, my son, my son. Well, let me suggest to you the first lesson that we ought to realize is that the brief pleasures of sin may lead to much heartache and shame. You think about the sins, that one night of sin, what that led to. It led to another sin in terms of a cover-up. It led to all these punishments. The sword never departed from David's house. David had to flee his own home. His son, his oldest son, raped one of his daughters. Three sons died, Amnon, Absalom, and the infant child. And the great shame that David experienced in having to leave his own house and having to walk up the Mount of Olives that we read a few minutes ago with his head covered, walking barefoot, weeping as he goes because his son is seeking his life. You know, sometimes we sometimes are presented with opportunities perhaps to commit sin. And we may think that, well, it's just one sin and it's something that won't lead to another thing. And We never know what path a sin may take us. I don't think David had any idea where that would lead him. If he had had any idea that the heartache and the turmoil that that one night of sin with Bathsheba would have led to, do you think he would have engaged in it? But he didn't have the ability to see that, and we don't have the ability to see where our sins will lead us as well. One sin may lead to a life-changing event. We have some good examples of Bible characters who refuse the brief pleasures of sin. Think about Moses, what the Bible says about Moses. And I think Jeff talked about this morning in his lesson in Hebrews, the 11th chapter. Let's just turn over and look at that. In verse 24, by faith Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. He had an opportunity. He could have lived as an Egyptian, basically. He was Pharaoh's daughter. He could have not even claimed to have been a Jew, I imagine. And he could have lived and probably fared sumptuously all his life. Yet he thought it better to suffer ill treatment with the people of God and wander through the wilderness. What about Joseph in chapter 39 of Genesis? Most of us are familiar with that story. Joseph had been mistreated by his own family, and he wound up being sold into Egypt. And he had begun to prosper as working as a servant in Potiphar's home. But his wife desired him and tried to get him to commit adultery with her, but he refused. And didn't look like at first that was going to be a wise decision on his part by the way the world looks at things. He wound up being put in jail. And some people would have thought, well, just go ahead. But he refused to do that and ultimately became second in command in Egypt as a result of that. And went down as one of the greatest Bible characters that we'll ever read about. Another lesson I think we can learn from this story is that the example and the guidance of parents may greatly influence the choices of their children. And I think that we sort of already alluded to this. Do you see how closely the actions of Amnon and Absalom are in terms of their connection to what David did? Do we ever have any evidence that Amnon was ever punished for what he did to Tamar? You know, what could David say? You can't live that way. That's wrong. He was angry about it. But what had David done? You know, David's influence had been hurt terribly. We see this principle in many of the kings of Israel and Judah. If you just have time, thumb through some time and look at the various kings of Israel and Judah, and oftentimes their sins are closely associated with that of their fathers or one of their ancestors. Think about the influence that Jeroboam had. And often the Bible will even equate a particular king to the sins of Jeroboam. But in a positive way, think about Timothy. The book of 2 Timothy tells us, and Paul is writing to Timothy saying, I know your faith. It was present in your grandmother, Lois, and in your mother, Eunice, or Eunice. You know, did Timothy obtain his faith by accident? Well, certainly not. Certainly not. And he says later on, you've known from a childhood the Holy Scriptures. Well, did he learn them by himself as a child? Well, the implication is that he learned them from his family. And we need to be aware as parents, all of us who are parents of children need to be aware that the example that we set, the decisions that we make, are going to have a great impact on what kind of decisions our children make, most likely. You know, if we show that religion is just, that we're not serious about our religion, and we show that it's just something that we do out of habit, and it's really not that important in our lives, most likely our children are going to be that way. Well, what's another lesson? The forgiveness of sins does not eliminate the consequences of sin. David was clearly forgiven of his sin, yet he still experienced the punishment for his sin. And that is true today. Sometimes people approach the idea of, well, I can always get forgiveness. I'm going to go ahead and do it, but I can always get forgiveness. Well, there are consequences associated with sins. David really experienced that, and many other Bible characters had experienced as well. Think about that of Adam and Eve. I believe the implication is that they were forgiven of their sins. I don't know if the Bible explicitly says that, but God did not just destroy them, but He removed them from the Garden of Eden. They couldn't live there anymore. And they experienced pain. They had to work. They had to sweat. Things that they had not experienced before. That was part of their punishment. Think about Moses. We looked at him as a positive, in a very positive light a few minutes ago. But in Numbers 20, at the waters of Meribah, the people were complaining because they didn't have any water. And God told them, speak to the rock, and the rock will give forth water. And Moses, for some reason, did not give glory to God. Instead, must we provide water? I believe that's how that reads. And he struck the rock. And God said, you're not going to bring the people into the land of Canaan. That was his punishment. Now, we know, I think, very clearly that he was one of the greatest Bible characters ever, who ever lived, and God certainly did not hold this against him in terms of his eternal salvation. But he still suffered the consequences of that sin. And so it is true with us today, just like David did. We should never make character assessments based on outward appearances. Think about Absalom. There was no defect in him, the Bible says. No one is handsome. No one so highly praised. And he appeared to be interested in other people. He stood at that gate and, you know, what's your case about? Where are you from? And he would pull the person close to him. And he would put forth this chariot to go before him. He looked like somebody, didn't he? He really looked like somebody. We should never make character assessments based on appearances. And that's really what our world is almost about today. You look at Hollywood, those are the most beautiful people, aren't they? And yet most of them are devoid of any kind of good character. And we need to be careful that we don't fall into that. Sometimes young people, when they're looking for a potential spouse, they're looking for the most attractive, beautiful person, and yet they may not have any character whatsoever. Absalom, it appears, had very little character to him. And yet he was one of the most highly praised people of all of Israel. The last point I want to make deals with David's attitude and his willingness to forgive. You know, despite all that Absalom had done, he sought his father's life. He committed fornication with his wives. He killed one of his sons. You know, we could go on and on at some of the things that he did. David never gave up on him. David was willing, in fact, up to the day that he died, he had sent word out, deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom, despite all that he did. And I'd like to think most of us parents feel that way about our children. Certainly doesn't mean we don't want them to go out and do the things that Absalom did by any stretch. But this was consistent with David's character, wasn't it? You know, David's character, think about his dealings with Saul. Saul sought to kill David numerous times. And yet when Saul died, did David rejoice at that? No. He sorrowed for Saul. He lamented over Saul and Jonathan. Of course, he was very close with Jonathan. But he lamented over Saul. And that's the kind of attitude I believe that God has for us in many ways. Not that God in any way excuses sin, and I don't want to charge that at all. But David was willing to die in place of Absalom. He said repeatedly, oh, that I would have died for you, or instead of you. And you think about God's attitude towards us. Jesus actually did that for us, didn't he? Jesus went to the cross and suffered the penalty for sin so that we would not be condemned. I hope those lessons are some things that will be beneficial to you. You might want to turn out, get your psalm books. Or it'll be on the overhead, I suppose, as well. You know, I got to thinking a little bit about the sorrow that David expressed for his son. You know, he expressed sorrow for the infant child as well. before it died, because God had said that child is going to die. And then after that child died, he ate and he got up and shaved himself, washed himself, prepared himself to get up and go about daily activities, even though he hadn't been doing that. And his servants were perplexed about that. You know, why are you acting this way? Before the child died, you were laying around, you wouldn't eat. And David made the point that, well, I thought while the child was alive, God might change his mind and show me mercy and let the child live. But when the child died, there was nothing I could do at that point. He said, you know, he's not going to come back to me, but I can go to him. Do you notice he didn't say that about Absalom? And I know that the concepts of heaven and hell, I don't believe, are developed in the Old Testament to nearly the extent that they are in the New Testament. But I wonder, as David thought about Absalom, thought about the life that Absalom lived, you know, would he have had hope for Absalom in terms of eternity? I don't know. And that makes me think of us today. You know, what if you died tonight? What would your loved ones be thinking? I know they would be sorrowful, regardless of your spiritual state. But would they be as sorrowful for you in terms of your spiritual state if you were unprepared to meet God? I think they would be even more sorrowful. You have an opportunity tonight to make yourself right with God, as one did this morning. We're so grateful for that. There are others here who are subject, who I believe are hopefully are ready to become Christians. And this is a great opportunity for you to do that. If you need to become a Christian, or if you need to become right with God, we offer that opportunity for you now while we stand and sing.